And I was involved a little bit in community work, and the price of inequality and the injustices sort of struck me at that point in time. And it's been a theme that's sort of, in many ways, driving me for almost my entire career since then. Is that the idea of people having such inequality, essential things that people would take for granted aren't available, seem to be not a good thing.
Soon after he was diagnosed with a dedifferentiated liposarcoma, Norman Coleman reached out to the Cancer Letter to initiate a series of interviews about his life and career. The plan was to continue recording these conversations for as long as possible. Coleman died March 1st at 79, having only completed one interview, which follows. At NCI, Coleman was the Associate Director of the Radiation Research Program, Senior Investigator in the Radiation Oncology Branch in the Center for Cancer Research, and leader of a research laboratory at NIH. He was also the founder of the International Cancer Expert Corps, a nonprofit he created to provide mentorship to cancer professionals in low and middle income countries, and in regions with indigenous populations in upper income countries. Coleman spoke with Otis Brawley and Paul Goldberg, co-editors of the Cancer History Project.
How are you, Norm?
Well, I had something occur that I didn't ever anticipated, which is, I think you're aware of some of it or not. I don't know.
I'm aware that you're ill.
Yeah. Yeah, I have an issue with cancer, unfortunately. Last September, I qualified for the Ironman 70.3 World Championships in New Zealand coming up this year. Probably aren't 20 people in the world that can still do that. Doing fine, had some symptoms, ended up with a malignancy that I'm doing battle with now. You know, you live a good life and you don't expect things to happen, but they do when you get into these age groups. So it's that challenge, yeah.
I'm sorry to hear that. You've always been an athletic kind of guy, but you used to run back in college, didn't you?
Yeah, and I've been doing this. I mean, you know, the half Ironman is a 1.2-mile swim, a 56-mile bike run, and a half marathon. I can still do these. I can still beat a lot of people, third my half my age. And, you know, we never expected, you know, cancer to be an issue. But, you know, it can be, so.
Yeah. Are you still living in, were you living in Somerset, was it?
Yeah. So, you know, things are largely the same. Live in Somerset. You know that area. Yeah, you both do. I'm still working in the radiation research program, you know, which is always a challenge during difficult times. I still work at the Administration for Strategic Preparedness and Response, which is ASPR, and I'm involved in a lot of what's going on in the world, and anything nuclear they bring me in, so I'm involved in that. One of the more exciting things is we had a concept of it was initially radiation inducible molecular processes. It's something we discovered in our lab that when you treat tumors and tumor cells, they adapt very quickly. We had a first in vivo paper showing that when you start treating tumors, they adapt very, very quickly. And that's just been accepted in molecular cancer therapeutics on Friday. So that's a really big deal. And, you know, a busy guy. And the other aspect, I think you both know, the global health we're doing, the International Cancer Expert Corps, which I think that it fits into both your characters. For people who have nothing in intolerable situations, that's not tolerable, and I think we've come a long way to doing that. So I got a lot of stuff going on. I'm, you know, trying to, you know how it is. You keep it going when you have to take care of treatments and stuff.
We're hoping that we can have a couple of, perhaps 3 hour long conversations, of which this is just one. I think the ICEC can take up one entire of those.
No, I really appreciate more than you can imagine, the opportunity to be able to talk about things and ideas, and particularly with friends. Geez, I've known you, both of you, for 40 years, something like that.
Hey, right.
So
Yeah.
you guys are very special.
Well, I'm going to tell you something that Eli once said about you. His comment was something like, "Sam Hellman has done a lot of good things for oncology, but the best thing he ever did was Norm Coleman."
Wow.
I hadn't
Yeah.
known that.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a small world, you know? It's like a little shtetl there of all of these characters who are just, you know, they just recur all the time, everywhere. And that's kind of that's why I'm thinking we should just go fairly slow so we can have the anecdotes.
Well, yeah.
As I was suggested, we should probably start with ICEC because that's your creation. Correct me if I'm wrong. Well, tell us what it is and what your role is, how did it come about, what's the rationale, the usual.
So things you both relate to, and you were probably almost part of that era. So when I was in med school, 1968, 69, at New Haven, they had the Black Panther trials. So those are the days of all the things were so bad, people would rather burn down the cities than live in them. And I was involved a little bit in community work, and the price of inequality and the injustices sort of struck me at that point in time. And it's been a theme that's sort of in many ways driving me for almost my entire career since then. Is that the idea of people having such inequality, essential things that people would take for granted aren't available, seem to be not a good thing. So the theme of that really percolated through my whole life. When I was able to do something about it, when I was a resident at Stanford, before Stanford, when I was a, you know, as a resident at Stanford, we took some rotations out in underserved places. And for those of you who remember the Bay Area, there was that, the East Bay was actually underserved at one time. If I had bought like 10 acres, I wouldn't have to be doing any of this. No, it was underserved. So I started going out. I used to see patients that, from the East Bay, the surgeons like me. I saw a lot of patients, and I would go out my half day off, go out and do tumor boards out in their hospital. So the whole idea of bringing cancer care to the community seemed to make sense, and bringing cancer care to where people needed it makes sense. So I finished medicine. I finished medicine at at UC San Francisco. You know, that was an interesting experience with everything. Finished NCI, the Public Health Service. So that's when I was at Stanford. So when I got to the Joint Center, it was just an amazingly, you know, interesting program. And the kind of like so it was the same sort of thing. How this guy Frank Govern and I. We're both sort of attuned to the community. When we first got there, we called Howard, talked to the head of the cancer center there. We said, "We'd like to come out and visit you." And they said, "You were the first people who ever called and came out to visit us." So it was, I mean, there may have been some along the way, but it was really striking how our ability and our interests would translate into both meaningful relationships with people, but people also appreciating people appreciated their situations. When I was at Stanford, we did set up our first community program. So the place in Fremont, we set up as a satellite at those days, which was sort of a new approach. But our satellites, rather than trying to pull people in, was to put high quality docs in the community, have the people stay in the community, and send the ones across Stanford, across to Stanford to do that. So in Boston, we started visiting a lot of the community hospitals, and you know the Boston area. There was the Boston hospitals, and you get 30 or 40 miles out, and there were nice people in nice hospitals. The quality of care was fair, and when you got farther out to the old mill towns like Fall River, New Bedford, Waltham Weston a little bit, there was almost no cancer care. Frank Govan, it was a young guy. He had been a hospital president who joined me as my COO, and he was very attuned to how things worked in the community. So we began setting up a very unique model, which we called an outreach program, not a satellite. Was the idea to bring expertise to the community in cancer care, or help develop expertise. They would do the local investment because they had the resources. So their local investment, our expertise, would begin to set up cancer programs. So the Joint Center had 2,500 new patients a year. When I finished, our outreach program had 2,500 new patients a year. And we were at some conference once, and someone from Switzerland said, "Your department sees more patients than my country." So it was a very robust model. And what was really unique is the I thought there were groups of academics, and I still think it's true, who don't want to be in the mothership. They don't want to be in private practice, but they would love to have an academic role in the community. So these folks in the community were full-time Harvard faculty. And that was sort of like Harvard was loose enough that they let me do that. And by being in the community, they had the prestige of Harvard faculty. They were part of our big Joint Center faculty. Everybody had a job that was the most important in the Joint Center, so everybody was valued. People had a little difference in salary for where they worked, and it was just a tremendously successful program. Good quality care, setting up things in the community, and we knew how to do this. So, like Fall River went from 8 patients to Fall River, New Bedford to 180 patients when we left, and heaven knows what happened to them, but we're able to deliver good care. So the idea of bringing care to the underserved was terrific, and that we had a skill, and we were really good at it, that knew how to bring these things forward. The next step was when I was a chair at Harvard. My wife and I had we took a year off and traveled around the world. We can get back to that from 74, 75. It was one of these times, and it's a nice anecdote when we get to that, of realizing we needed to educate ourselves. So we traveled around the whole world, from Asia, Africa. We took a bus across the Khyber Pass. We were hikers, so we went to a lot of the mountains. So we were very, very comfortable with different cultures. And in fact, because of the experiences we had in foreign cultures, we took our kids to those. In 1974, 1994, my kids and a family and a few families spent 7 weeks in Nepal. And for those who are familiar with the Asian cultures, it was around the Everest region, which is the Tibetan Buddhist culture. And it's not about religion. It's about how these people live in harmony, how they look after one another, and how they approach the world with different kind of equanimity. So we had this wonderful trek out there. We had very close friends. I taught myself Nepali enough to get around. When we were coming back on the trek, we said, "These are wonderful people. We'd love to help them." And I said, "Well, what do I know that I can do that they could that could be helpful?" And I said, "Well, I know how to set up cancer centers." At Harvard, we had what we called the Nepal Project, which has two ideas, and you'll both appreciate that. Now, I looked at my faculty. They were wonderful. Most of them thought you had to get vaccinated to cross the Charles River. And I figured that they would do really well by spending a month in this culture, but they wouldn't go to travel. So I said, well, we're going to go there to try to set this up as you being mentors, going out there to teach, recognizing they would really be going out there to learn. So the effort at the Nepal Cancer Center was a really solid one. We had raised some money, we were ready to do it, and then it got caught in Harvard politics. So it was sort of getting towards the end of my term there. We had enough money in one of the foundations I had that we could have helped them build and run a cancer center. That did not come to pass. And again, it's on the anecdotal side of stuff. I remember we worked at it really hard. And I had some good friends in Nepal who were senior in the country, very, very people. And I remember I came back and said, you know, I'm really sorry. We just failed. We couldn't get this done. All the politics got in the way and things like that. And I said, you didn't fail. I said, do you realize what it meant to our country that someone like you was willing to put in so much to help us? You've changed the way we think about ourselves. So it was that realization that what we do with our character, our intentions, our trying to do things, in some ways succeeding is important, but in some ways is really meaningful. And meaningful in just a simple humanitarian way, that the cross-culturalism, which we loved, when we love India and the craziness, caring about people, putting in the effort, goes a really, really long way. So we knew we had something we wanted to do. The sad thing about my outreach program was that part of the reason I left Boston was patients becoming customers, all the hospital wars. I understood why they were doing the wars, but it wasn't a thing for me. Our outreach program was a different hospital system, so they all got, you go with us, you go with that. So the outreach group was like a whole separate division of the Joint Center. I think people did reasonably well. They kept their jobs, but the idea of this community entity really bringing good things out to the community sort of ended. The next thing in that happened when we came back to NIH, and this fellow Frank Garvin joined me at NIH. And again, interested in global health, and there's a man named Samir Khalif, I think you probably both know.
No.
So Samir was interested in, so Rick Clouser made some arrangements with Jordan, and Samir Khalif was going to go out and do something in Jordan. And he called Frank and said, Frank, what do I do? Sort of thing. So because of our experience, and other people, we helped sort of guide Samir into how you go about building this program. He's a very honorable, very trustworthy guy. How it takes time to build trust in all these community settings. You want to do something, the first 2 years of people realizing you're the real deal, and then all the doors open up. So Samir helped build that program. That was the Al Amal Cancer Center that became the King Hussein Cancer Center with local investment. Samir being on site, bringing in resources of mentorship to help them do their own work, them building up their excellence. And now they're the major cancer center in the Middle East. And they're part of ICEC with the idea of you empower people to solve problems. And another thing we would do when we worked as communities, we listen, the first thing do first few things you do when you go to communities is you listen, you listen, you listen. I added a fourth one now. You listen, you hear, and then you listen. So we'd listen to the communities, give them what they asked for, give them what they should have asked for, and the same deal. And again, we had a very successful approach, we think, to building cancer programs. So we started to do that initially within the NCI. And the NCI is funny because it does global science, and it's not a healthcare institution. So we're interested in So we set up two programs. The first was suitable with the NCI, which is the Cancer Disparities Research Partnership Program. And the CDRP was, again, Frank Govern's idea. And what cancer centers have to do, they look at their bar graphs and they have to have a certain mix of people, to pass their reviews. And they tried to do that. I mean, there were, again, honorable efforts. But what often happened was it was the trickle down. You know, the funds went from the big cancer center to the little cancer center. So Frank Govern had this great idea. He said, let's turn this around. Why don't we give the big grant to the little guys, the disparities place? Cancer centers would have to, they wanted their numbers for their center. Telemedicine was just being invented, and the NCI had telesynergy. So we were setting up a program where there was grantees who actually got the grant. Centers in the community competed to be their mentors. And then we ended up being successful in 3 out of 6 programs, all to some extent, the biggest one being Rapid City, South Dakota, where, again, the Native Americans were sort of like a lot of these foreign countries. Dan Petterite, who ran that, the first 2 years, he couldn't get anybody on study. He would go around to tribe after tribe after tribe, telling them what they were trying to do. After 2 years, they trusted him, and the whole doors opened up to him. The building of trust was what really launched the Cancer Disparities Research Partnership. Whatever DEI is worth, I think it's worth a lot. We recognized DEI was present in 1990s, and I think this is an innovative a program to that. So, having experience, having success, knowing what we knew how to do, we went ahead with the to try to do global health, and we tried to do some kind of like a cancer peace corps within NCI. And there really wasn't quite a model for that. So the ICEC was really a Cancer Peace Corps to develop mentorship corps where people who would be mentors to help remote places, low and middle income countries who are willing to invest in themselves to then have investment. And what's really needed in all these is expertise. So the expertise was local people and us mentoring the expertise. So that's been the ICEC model of how do you get expertise and how do you get it in low and middle income countries and how do you make these alliances or these the partnerships. And the bottom line in these things is all trusted partnerships. As I like to say, the three of us are on the call and we sort of know each other and you trust each other. And so much of the world runs on very modest sized groups of people who truly are trusted partnerships with the ethics, characteristics, integrity. You know, we argue, we have lab meetings and we haggle, but the idea you're in it for the right reason. And that's sort of the basis of what the International Cancer Expert Corps is.
ICSC is outside NCI. And when did you begin? When did it start? How did it go outside?
So went outside with Harold. We had a discussion with Harold Varmus, and he looked at it and said, you know, I'm not sure this fits in there, but he said, this is a good idea. So we said, why don't you do this as an NGO? And we felt, well, we're being, you know, should we or should we not? And it was in about 2012, 2013, we tried to put this together. In 2014, we actually became incorporated as a 501c3. So we were an official entity. We're in our second 10 years now. And we began putting together groups of people we thought would be interested in this. A lot of the people who were really interested in global health, who we thought could potentially do this. We had a lot of what we call normals, you know, people from the Peace Corps. We knew it was a great idea. Ellen Stovall, you know, was a really close friend of mine. And I came back to work to Washington in many ways to work with Ellen. And I told Ellen, we're doing this, would you like to join us? And she said, you know, she was working with NCCS. She said, absolutely, what you are doing is what NCCS was 25, 30 years ago. This is the next step in bringing care to the community. And we've been building ever since. I'm putting together a core of people, putting together young investigators. we've gotten a lot of advice, and it's a fairly complicated story. But what you learn, you either depend on donations or you have to have some source of income. We thought we would get much more buy-in from the accelerator companies. We thought they would love us to help open up new markets. For complicated reasons, I've learned, they have their markets, and we were looking at a sort of a different part of the world. We recognize you needed new technology. That if you have technology that could generate revenue, and the technology could also improve cancer care, that was a win-win situation. So we started working on getting potential investors. I had a I there's a meeting, international conference for translational radiation oncology, Physics for Health Europe, that I was supposed to give a talk at, and at the physics part, and I was going to give a talk on some usual topic. I said, I can give you this usual topic, but let me tell you about an idea I have about bringing cancer care to the underserved. These are physicists, okay? So I gave this talk. I walked out the door, expect to get, fruit thrown at me. When I walked outside the door, there was Ugo Amaldi, who helped invent the linear accelerator, whose father was the first director general of CERN. And he came up and told me, "We can build for you a better linear accelerator." And the physicists began to rally around that. And I didn't progress that much. A couple of years later, when I came back to another meeting, he grabbed me by the shirt and said, "We have to do this project. It's really important." So we began getting collaborative programs with really, really smart physicists, some of which were at CERN, some of which were the Science and Technology Facilities Council in the UK. They invested in us. We're designing novel technology, smart technology. It's a technological leap. I think the level of linear accelerators and things, like anything you can do, without having to take your grandfather technology, you can really move. So we're in part of where ICEC is now is getting together some really, really smart technology. We're building a core of people who want to become experts. We're giving out grants now. We have a grant, the Coleman Kaplan grant, which is again another side story from Paul Kaplan, who was Henry Kaplan's son. I was Henry Kaplan's doctor at Stanford, and I became very close to the Kaplan family. And Paul passed away, but he gave us $1 million endowment to start mentorship programs. So we're at the crux right now, where we've developed a healthcare model system. It's very smart policy people. We publish all this stuff. It's all peer reviewed. We think the ICEC is at a point with the right investment, we could finally change the paradigm of local investment, cores of mentorship, trusted relationships, all the knowledge bases that are now accessible to really bring expert cancer care in an exponential way. The shortage of linear accelerators now at 5,000 around the world. We wouldn't tolerate that. The number I like to use, if we could commission one great, well-staffed linear accelerator a week, it would take 100 years to solve the current shortage. So I call it the century challenge: is how quickly can we, by using exponential models, solve this? And again, we think we have the model. We think we have the technology. We think we have all this. We're at the point we're looking for investment, but we think it's really a paradigm shift, for the entire world, and also for the United States and the Western world to be active as a conglomerate working together for low and middle income countries. We're members of the IAEA, Trusted Partnership. We're members of the UN Council of NGOs. We're now advisory on the WHO NGOs. We're really becoming a big entity. We're known around the world. Department of Energy comes to us for information. So this interview is interesting because we're at really the a really major point in time now that if we can do this, it would be so much good, and it would be opportunity for altruism that is sometimes not so easy to come by in the world of medicine we have now. And then with modern diagnostics, modern information shortage, you can do so much with less by smart technology. So that's where ICEs is now, and that's
But it started out smaller, right? And it just this mission kind of grew on you. Is that how it, or was this the mission from the start? Like when you're meeting with Harold, like what do we do about this thing, Harold? And he says, make it into an NGO. Okay, we'll make it into an NGO. What was the picture in your mind of the NGO you're building?
It was a cancer Peace Corps. Like it was the Peace Corps, the government may give us some money, some companies would give us money. We would have a core of mentors. We would end up trying to do guideline protocol-based cancer care, but as ways of mentoring people, teach them how to fish, sort of thing. You could support people with some money, so they could do this as part of a career, not on Saturdays and Sundays. So it's basically a cancer Peace Corps where people could spend part of their time as part of their careers being mentors, building the kind of relationships of trust, educating the educators, by learning about cultural things you can learn in culture. And that's how we started to do that. And is when we realized when we were not going to get money for this easily. Government was going to do it. Industry was not going to do it. And we had to try to figure a way of getting some kind of something that could help fund the core, could have a source of some kind of income. And what we would hope, we would have enough funds to be able to have people become the mentors. It's an expert core. It's getting expertise on the ground to build from the people on the ground where they can become the experts, and doing what we did in CDRP, and doing what we did in Jordan. Jamal Cato, these are the best cancer center in the world because they were mentored, they got confidence, and now they mentor their region. So develop an exponential model. What took us a lot of time is we didn't have the money to pay people, how NGOs are. And we had to develop a model, both a business model and a science model and a technology model that could potentially raise funds to sustain this. And the last 5 or 6 years is working with physicists, CERN, policy people, to create models that are solving a healthcare model, and you treat cancer rather than you have a healthcare system buy experimental expensive stuff. So we've really changed an entire paradigm. So it's been those 7 or 8 years of putting this together to where we actually something that someone may invest in. We spent a fair amount of money doing fundraising. People don't invest in the underserved. And we're also showing it a way that when you do this sort of thing, it's really good for you. It makes people feel good. It's good for the people you're helping. It's good for diplomacy. It's good for world peace. And a lot of diplomacy is, as we all know, shockingly happens through physicians in countries. A lot of ministers of this and ministers of that are physicians. So trusted networks is so much one can get out of that. So it went from everybody would give us money, it's so obvious, to no one would give us money, to how to build something that would be interesting. And I think what we put together is really a fascinating model of that addresses NCDs, infectious diseases, a model we call flex competence. Some of the model of how to deal with these disasters comes from my work down in HHS, of how when some disaster happens, you have to be able to deploy things and you have to be ready. So it really pulls together a lot of things I know, and the people I'm working with are just absolutely brilliant people from all aspects of policy, government, healthcare, physics, technology. It's sort of amazing. And if someone gets us the money we're looking for now, and I'm not allowed to ask for it, we could be a major force globally in 3 to 5 years.
There are a couple of themes here I want to try to follow up on. One theme is helping people in communities and elsewhere practice a better quality of medicine. I heard that talking about Oakland and San Francisco area. You did that a great deal with the Joint Center. You're doing that with ICEC now. So it's really community outreach to try to improve quality of care. Is that right?
Yeah, it's just because you're poor, it doesn't mean you should have bad care.
Yeah.
It's yeah, and it's that it's helping, but it's also what I learned as a community worker and what I learned traveling. There's so much richness. You, when you go out there to teach, you're going out there to learn. So to develop these ways of not just them getting care, but linking it to a greater network, so they're part of something, not just a little group out there. They're part of something that's really trying to transform the way care is given, and the way people interact.
Yeah. How do you in Boston and also in California, how do you overcome the fact that many of the people you're trying to work with are your competition?
Well, a lot of this is working in places that, the competition doesn't want to go. I've got a lot of these out of the way places people don't care that much about. It's very difficult. I mean, it's and you see it even with global health programs. The idea you need one Linac a week will take you 100 years. There's a lot of wonderful programs out there that are trying to build a cancer program with one or two countries and developing wonderful programs. Maybe they get a Linac every few years. As can they somehow pull together to realize this problem is so big. There's so much for all of us to do. And if we can get past this competition, that the competition is the need we're trying to meet rather than competing with each other. Someone once gave me a great piece of advice and it was quite brilliant. He says, if you can't solve a problem, make it bigger. And this really applies to this to some extent. The problem is so big, there's so much opportunity. It takes such a great team. You develop the camaraderie you have doing house officer training or grad school that we're in is to try to solve a problem together. We did this with the CDRP. And this you tap into a natural aspect of people. And you don't need a million. And my only number is if I had two people from every state being volunteers for ICEC giving me 8 hours a week, that would be a lot. And you go to different countries, you don't need millions, you need hundreds, you need people dedicated to do this. So you create the right environment. And again, I think I'm one thing I like to do and I think I'm good at is creating environments. So it was about that, but realizing you there's so much good out there that you can do, and there's so much good you get in return, and altruism is, it's a rare thing. But you do things for no good for yourself, just to do good for yourself. People feel generally, good about themselves.
Now, when I think of linear accelerators, you said 5,000 linear accelerators needed. There's a lot of places that need linear accelerators, but they don't have clean water and stable electrical grid.
So you said it's a healthcare systems problem. There are certainly plenty of them right now that are stable enough that you can do that. So the design of our accelerator, we had a meeting at CERN, and the goal of this is exactly what you had in mind is you need robust, stable equipment that doesn't need a repairman to come in. That can work in the harsh environments and can perform, and it doesn't need to be at the level of the most expensive linear accelerator. It's got to be really, really good. So the first meeting at CERN was which was spurred on by the folks we met at CERN and someone named Manjit Dosanjh, who was the biologist working at CERN. The first meeting at CERN is how can we go about doing that? We brought people from companies, a lot of other things. So again, part of the radiation world is you get to see cool things. So I'm an advisor for NASA, and I was involved on NASA space flight. So before we had our first meeting, I contacted my friends at NASA and said, "Could you send us a NASA engineer who understands the space station? Because we're looking at these out of the way places like the space station. When something breaks, how do you modularize it? How do you use smart technologies to know what's going to break?" So that was built into all of this. It's smart technology, ease of repair, not needing a serviceman, robustness. So exactly what you said was built in. And there are solutions in some places. A lot of places buy Linux from these companies and they have no one to run them. So the answer is there was enough places easily to do what we needed to do for years, but also the example of when you start doing things that succeed, other people want to join in. So it's pilots that succeed. It's Jamal Kadar who shows that we can do working with them. We're working in Baganda, we're working in CDRP. So I think people see we know how to succeed.
How many linear accelerators have you installed?
We haven't put any, and we haven't for a while, but we're the mentorship core is agnostic. So there's a mentorship core that'll help anybody anywhere. They need to do some local investment and they need to put in enough to have some staffing, some equipment, and some education. So we're going to mentor people already at some level of education. And there are a number of places for us to do that. Some countries order 10 Varians. They get them delivered and they don't have the capacity to take care of them. The machines are excellent. So what we're trying to do is trying to develop the expertise mentorship that enables these folks. And then when our own equipment is out, we think we'll be able to have technology that can do what we're trying to do because we're addressing the technology for the situation that's going to be working. It's going to be in, Uganda or Botswana, not in New York City. And because we don't have legacy issues, we can, I mean, the creativity, well, you know that. The creativity you can do, we want the iPhone. And there's no reason you can't have an iPhone with the right sort of people. But we're agnostic to mentorship.
What
we
about
just need
Ukraine? Because I think they were putting in a huge order for linear accelerators. Are you involved in that?
Yeah, again, indirectly, not directly enough, but we're aware of that. Again, we need money to be, we need to be able to build up enough of a core that people can actually commit, 20% of their time. We're hoping academic departments would see this as valuable, global health. So people get a research day. So people could have a research day. We can have the cores. We can work with folks around the world, seeing what each center needs, and develop education and training. Ukraine's really good. I mean, there's a lot of stuff already there. Some of it they're running in short supply because people aren't there. So yeah, we're aware of, and those are the kind of situations where, I'm not sure how much mentorship they need. I think they need some mentorship. I think being part of a global partnership would really be rewarding for them. I think the person-to-person connectivity keeps people working in situations because what they're doing is valued and matters. It's not you're in, hinterland. So I think being part of something bigger with a real mission keeps people's level of spirit of what they're trying to do high. And Ukraine helps a lot of their neighbors. Ukraine's terrific. So we are aware of Ukraine. Again, there's only so much we can do, but that's the kind of a place we talk about. And again, I see Ukraine from my nuclear side, so I'm fairly well aware of what's going on, from ASPR and NATO and things. It's the caring. It's amazing how much, again, it's trusted partnership and character, and that drives so much. And you build it up in a place, and it can really transform how places take care of themselves. We've done that. We know it works.
Now, how many people are involved with ICEC?
So we probably have people putting in a reasonable amount of work frequently is probably 20. We have two full-time employees. You know how that is. All right. Two full-time employees, a lot of volunteers. We have a list of people who would look for things to do. We just started giving out grants, the Coleman Kaplan grants, and these are research projects. So people, residents go in rotation, going to a place, the answer is don't just sit there. Take notes. What did you do that got you to where you decided to do that? What you were able to do? Did you think of? Did you do anything that you thought you'd do? Write all this up, and when you're finished, you'll have a nice paper. But you're also going to have specific aims for a research grant. You can say, are there questions there I can ask? So we funded a number of small grants. They've gone very, very well, surprisingly. When we started giving out our first Ellen Stovall grants a couple of years ago, we would give out, a couple of thousand dollars to get letters from deans. They were very appreciative that someone saw this work as valuable. So if we had $50 million, $100 million, which we'd like to get, we could rapidly begin to set up the expertise core. And then the issue would be, as you alluded to, Paul, how do you get people on the ground who are willing to match with that? But it's like what I learned in Nepal. What is Norm Coleman doing out here in Kathmandu and doing something? And when I got on the call with Bugando, so we tried to do a cancer center. I was out there. I could speak Nepali in a laughable way. And I gave this little talk in Nepal in the groundbreaking ceremony. So when I got on the call with Bugando, they said, I know you. You were the one in Kathmandu talking about the Nepal Cancer Center in 1996. Like immediate affinity. And I could use my seven Nepali phrases. So it's that sort of connectivity that's surprisingly available around the world. So I think if we had money to begin these partnerships, if we could afford the mentorship, mentorship is not that expensive. It's buying people's time, having their time valued. And I think with some medical schools realizing it's important, getting enough money so the department says, you're not doing something for nothing. You're bringing something in, bringing in recognition to the department, it would go a long way. The recognition to the department came with the NCCCP program, Donna O'Brien and the John Nidiuba's program. And that was the similar idea that the patients were in the community. Why don't we bring the cancer clinical trials to the community? And we said, how we have to give them all this money stuff. I said, look, we need to give them enough. At least when I was nuts, we need to give them enough money so they could run their program. But the opportunity for them to participate in this would be so valuable to them that they would give us a lot of things just for the opportunity to participate. And I think that that side of the equation that people sort of miss. And then again, that's what I think came from my world travel, my love of differences, love being in the community. We get a boot out of things that go on there, and just the feeling of helping. I think that's a key missing ingredient. Mm-hmm. Needs money. You got to be able to, people have to own their time to be able to do this. And we're depending on a lot of retirees too. So we think there's, so we wrote a paper on the value of global health for aging, because you have the people who are 65, 70, they don't want more money anymore. They don't want to work 80 hours a week. They want to work eight hours a week, 10 hours a week. They'll give you the time. You need to just have it organized so they can mentor, and they love to mentor. So the idea of we can have a lot of senior mentors mentoring junior mentors, mentoring international mentors, having these circles of mentorship that these mentors then go forth and now you can see it being exponential. So we also addressed aging, which I think is a big issue. And we got really, really interesting buy-in in Singapore when we talked about this, because a lot of these societies, people live forever, and they're looking for things to do. So there's a lot of stuff there, but when you think about it, it's actually quite workable. Just needs some money. Everything does a little bit. And the technology, the thing we're doing with technology is really, it's really fabulous.
Where do you think an area of the world that is most ripe for expansion in terms of cancer care, improvements in cancer care, radiation oncology? Is it, I know the American Cancer Society was very focused on Africa for a time. You seem to be very focused on Central Asia, but is there one area that you think is really ripe right now that's not being addressed?
Yeah. So what we've done is we've done on the ground studies of Africa, the Balkans, and the former Soviet Union countries. And we've gone to the places, we have surveys, we actually understand their needs. They're all in big needs. Africa is the most obvious, although a lot of places aren't much better than that. And there's a great deal of interest in Africa for a lot of reasons other than cancer. So Africa is certainly one. Again, we're working now, and we have a group in Moldova this today going out there to help them. They're getting a LINAC. How do we help them build the expertise they need for the LINAC? So I think there's a lot of places. And I think what's good is a lot of people and Americans come from various countries. So there's a lot of affinities, people from they want to go back and help their countries. They can do that. They can become the mentor for their own countries. People select places they want. Again, we've talked to, again, we have a number of universities who are part of ICEC. So we're working with Duke in their program. We work a little bit with Indiana. So we sort of try to partner up with places that already have programs that we can, again, build that on model, help build pilot programs. So a lot of it is organic. Someone comes, can you help us here? And the answer is, yeah, let's see what we can do. Let's see what your needs are. And do we have the resources? Can we muster the expertise to do that? And that just needs money at this point. Needs money to be able to have people be able to do it.
I was just thinking, maybe my function is to slow things down. So you mentioned the New Haven outreach program you were first involved in. And I'm seeing this is really part of your kind of the core of what you do during the time of the Black Panthers trials. What was that like? How did you know you were at the right doing the right thing? How did you know that that was needed?
So I was a, again, I was a, med student. I thought we lived in this underserved community. I should do something. I should try to help these folks. It just seemed like something worth doing. So there was a thing called the Community Health Visitor Program, and the interested people called the visiting nurse. The visiting nurse said, "Yeah, we'd love to have people go out as a med student. Do we give you a couple of families?" And you would help them access the healthcare system. That's like a nice thing to do. And I was given this wonderful family, and you spent time there. You began to know them. You get the familiarity, and it was just I loved my visits there. There were always nice visits. I could help them with their what they were doing, and we had again we had this a bit of an affinity. But you realize how wonderful these people were, the people, the invisibles, but they were substantial people. So the city was cooking up. And I just, I wasn't a rabble rouser. And so when things were happening, they were talking to me, they were giving me some information of what was happening. I really could understand from how they looked at the healthcare system and how they looked at Yale, why all the anger, all that sort of stuff. So that was just, I think, happened. I happened to be there for a different reason at the right time. I wasn't so much involved in what was going on in New Haven, but understanding, I think, viscerally understanding and being out with the people who were getting nothing, you really appreciated how the world looked to them. It was the compassion. It was just wrong.
What were the challenges they were facing?
Challenges was access to they had six kids, access to healthcare. They had a problem. They had no idea what to do. A Dr. Coleman or I go over. Wasn't there were dial-up phones those days. You'd go up there once a week. What they had issues. How you doing? Visit some of the kids. Most of the kids were happy, healthy kids. I think they enjoyed getting to know me. I was, 20 something. I wasn't that a little older than some of their kids. The family, it was just a nice relationship.
Do you remember their name?
Yeah, but I do remember all the kids. I don't
Are
know.
you in
Yeah,
touch?
what? No, we lost touch. when I left New Haven. That mean there that was like 60 years ago. You know, we didn't, you know, we when we left, it was you know, hopefully someone else would have taken that over. It was a very individual program, and individual people in med school how to do that. And I don't think there were a lot of people who did that.
What
I
were
think a
the
lot of
medical challenges? Were you just showing up because you wanted to show up, say hello, or were you helping them with something medical?
it was both. I was like their GP, so I'd go in periodically when things are okay, just to see how they're doing, talk to them. They often didn't even know what questions to ask. How are you doing? How are you feeling? There was a vaginal bleeding, or some kid had some kind of thing, and you helped make the connection to help the kid get into the right clinic. You know, we were med students, so we weren't really being doctors. We could explain things to them. They understood the system, and so it was mostly that. I think having someone who actually cared about them was a big deal. You know, that you learn about their personal lives and their, you know, their relationships. And you began to realize how much people trust you because you're a doctor. You know, they didn't know who I was, but quickly developed these levels of trust, because of what you're trying to do. Again, seeing, I had a bit of an insider's view of the Black Panther riots because I could see it from people on the on the Hill, how unfair things were. Most of them were not violent, you know, but how unfair it was, and that just shouldn't be.
What were they thinking? What were their thoughts on the subject? What were they saying to you? Because it's nice when people tell you what they think.
I don't think we had that level of conversation.
Okay.
I think it was more, how much more comfortable they got when they had medical problems after they got to know me. When something came up, they would bring up, you know, oh, by the way, you know, Carl has this, and what do you think of that? So, and other things may come up. It was just the level of trust that they would access what I could potentially help them with. And I think that was really touching. And again, the idea that being out there for the right reason, and people sense that, you know that, Paul. You know, you're right as much as anybody. People understand that. And I think that kind of a rewarding thing for me too is interesting. When the tough things are happening, they would say, you know, we hear there's rumors, and you know, it's supposed to come out next couple of days. Don't, you know. We communicate, or the nurse would say, "Look, I went to see the family, and they said, you know, be a little careful. You know, the sort of rumblings going on." So they've warned me, you know, don't come out.
What did they call you? Did they call you Norm? Did they call you Doctor?
I think it was always Doc. They
Doc?
knew, yeah, they knew I was a med student. Yeah, I mean, it was like it was the formality of a patient physician. It was like being a GP.
So you took them over whenever they needed something. You referred them to the right people, and so.
Yeah, I got you know, we needed a clinic, so I'd help them get to the number, or they figured out. I said, call this number, and they would do their visits.
How long were you at the NCI the first time?
2 years and 2 months.
Oh.
I was yeah, I stayed for 2 years, and then it was 73 and 74, and then my wife and I decided to travel around. 74, 75 was a year traveling around the world, so I finished up a few projects. Yeah, so I was on the medicine branch, pediatric oncology branch. Then I was Bruce Chabner's second fellow, you know, doing pharmacology. Then we decided to travel around the world, and I decided to go into radiotherapy after that. You know, the NCI years were with a double free space, account of my internal medicine and account of my medical oncology. So I was able to get double boarded from that. Those are the most wonderful years imaginable.
And and then you trained in radiation oncology where?
That's Stanford.
At Stanford. Whit Kaplan.
Yeah, so I was going to radiation oncology. So when I was finishing NCI, to take the year off, My mother-in-law had an abdominal mass. We thought she had ovarian cancer. So I went to Chapter and said, "Look, Bruce, can I stay another year as a fellow here because I may have to stay around for my mother?" And he came back the next day and said, "Oh, no, you can't stay as a fellow. We want to put you on staff," which I thought was very touching. But I was sort of gravitating towards radiation. And Vince had just been on sabbatical at Stanford when I got to the medicine branch. So he said, can't go to radiotherapy, stay with us, sort of thing. But if you go train with Henry Kaplan," and I'm sure he contacted Henry Kaplan. So when I got there, that's a whole nother story. But I was a board certified medical oncologist starting a radiotherapy residency, and because I was at NCI, I treated as much Hodgkin as anybody. So when I was a radiotherapy resident, they used to have chemotherapy clinics called MOP clinics. So I had a MOP clinic as well in some of my years at Stanford. But it was with Henry Kaplan. Everybody said, if you go there, you got to work with Eli Gladstein. You know, Mark Green, all the folks there who were already at Stanford. John Glick said, you work with Eli. So I got hooked up with Kaplan, who was, enormous, and Eli.
Oh, I know, having hung out with Eli, I know about Dr. Kaplan.
And I developed a nice relationship with Dr. Kaplan.
I have a process suggestion. Why don't we start from childhood next time we talk
Okay.
in Brooklyn?
Okay.
And things always start in Brooklyn. And 1 hour.
Thinking about
And then, we covered a lot. I'm so glad we started with the ICEC question, and that. So I'm really looking forward to the next meeting. Otis, do you have questions
So
that?
I was just noting that that Brooklyn seems to swing a little heavier than its weight in terms of people and contributing. Earlier today, I was talking to Klausner, who's from Brooklyn. Everybody's from Brooklyn except you and I, Paul.
I know I'm from Moscow. Speaking of Moscow, I gotta ask you this, Norm. I've been meaning to ask you this for years, if you can help me with this. My mother, after she finished the Moscow Institute of Foreign Languages, she was not KGB at all. No, not even nowhere near, was asked to translate for a bunch of American physicians who oncology cancer people who came to America to the Soviet Union. And she said that she was translating for this Jewish doctor from California whose name seemed to be Kaplan. Kaplan's not a name you miss because. So if there are any photographs that the Kaplans have, they might have a photo of my mother being their translator.
Yeah, I think that era, the Kaplans, I can ask them if they have anything from that era, but I would doubt they would. But
Okay.
may well have been. He was very international. Again,
Well,
he
he
was
was
such
there for, I mean, it's in the book where he's visiting when rightfully at the time when my mother is graduating, and I would have been like a year old or something like that.
Did you ever read, you read Charlotte Jacobs' book on Henry Kaplan?
Yeah, that's what I'm
Okay.
referring to.
Yeah, so that was in the book?
She said she was there.
Yeah.
I didn't realize there's a book on Henry Kaplan.
It's a great
Oh,
book.
it's a great
I
book,
asked
Charlotte.
her whether she's ever seen any photographs, and she said she has none, but she was going to ask the family, and I don't think she did. But if they have it, that would be pretty amazing. Because this does for no not do nothing with it. It's
Well,
just
I'll ask. I mean, the daughter is the last one left, and the son-in-law, and the son-in-law is on our ICEC. The Kaplans are very tied into that. No, I'll ask him if they have any photographs from those days. I'm happy to ask. I mean, I don't know if they still have that archived.
And the other thing I
But
want to mention
but
on this.
that's interesting.
Yeah, it would be really fascinating to.
Thank you for listening to the Cancer History Project podcast, podcasts of oral histories and interviews with the people who have shaped oncology as we know it. Our archives are available online for free at cancerhistoryproject.com. You can also follow us on Twitter at @cancerhistproj. The Cancer History Project is a collaborative historical resource operated by the Cancer Letter. This is an ongoing project and would not be possible without the input and materials provided by our editorial board, our contributors, and the support of our sponsors, including Cedars-Sinai, Roswell Park Comprehensive Cancer Center, MD Anderson Cancer Center, and many others. View a full list of our sponsors at cancerhistoryproject.com/sponsors. If your institution would like to participate in the Cancer History Project, email us at admin@cancerhistoryproject.com.